From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it. You can do that today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you, thank you, thank you. You're helping keep this show on the air. Now, if you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, a diverse coalition of activists, including Interfaith Alliance, gathered at the Supreme Court on Wednesday to rally in support of reproductive rights. While a ruling on a restrictive Louisiana law is likely months away, observers variously noted Chief Justice Roberts' apparent reluctance to upend very recent court precedent in a very similar case, while others claimed to have seen signals that severe restrictions on abortion seem inevitable. Also this week, the Attorney General of the United States addressed a gathering of American religious broadcasters and laid bare the greatest challenge facing this nation: secular tyranny. That's right. With all that's happening in the world right now, it's the oppression of the domineering political religious right, the one with its prosperity gospel pastors praying over the president in the Oval Office, the one with a vice president leading anti-coronavirus prayer circles, and a Secretary of State who has previously confessed belief in the imminent rapture managing relations with Israel, the one with over 3,000 radio stations and hundreds of television and cable stations. Yes, in this Christianist environment, Bill Barr told religious broadcasters secular oppression is the existential threat facing our nation. And in a victory for the shadowy Project Blitz theocratic campaign, the Oklahoma State House this week passed a bill that would mandate the phrase "In God We Trust" on hundreds of public buildings. In the past couple of years, over a dozen compliant state legislatures have been moving and passing similar initiatives, usually starting with public schools. But of course, never stopping there. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
Governor Ralph Northam has officially signed a bill into law banning conversion therapy for minors. Conversion therapy attempts to forcibly change an individual's sexual orientation or gender identity. The practice has been blasted by many medical organizations.
This week saw the 20th state in the union and the first southern state pass a ban on the quack practice of ex-gay therapy on minors. As Virginia's governor signs House Bill 386, we'll get a briefing from National Center for Lesbian Rights Born Perfect Campaign, Virginia Ambassador Adam Trimmer.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
Few groups of us have been as directly impacted by the election of Donald Trump as have Muslim Americans. As the 2020 campaign rolls on, the Muslim Public Affairs Council has issued a comprehensive voter guide. We'll get details from Impact Communications Manager Rahima Shaab. But first,
we're seeing major changes in the Democratic primary field right before the biggest delegate day of the race. Joe Biden won big in South Carolina. The former vice president pulled in nearly half of the total vote, finishing about 30 percentage points ahead of Bernie Sanders. On Sunday, Pete Buttigieg ended his campaign. The former South Bend, Indiana mayor started off relatively unknown. He had a slim victory in Iowa and a second-place finish in New Hampshire. However, Buttigieg wasn't able to expand his success after that.
Right, Reverend Gene Robinson is the former Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire, the first openly gay person elevated to that role in historic Christianity. Bishop Gene Robinson will weigh in on the historic presidential run of openly gay, openly religious Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Gene, it's always great to talk with you, and I thank you so much for being with us again today.
Thank you, Elton. You know I always say yes to you.
Well, I am so glad. when did you first become aware of Mayor Pete's campaign?
Well, I became aware of Mayor Pete when he ran for the Democratic National Committee chair a couple of years ago. And so then he seemed to come out of nowhere. But when he started his campaign about a year ago, or at least I became aware of it about a year ago, his was a name that was familiar to me, although I had never met him.
Mm-hmm.
I have a general practice that when someone who is LGBTQ sort of comes onto the national scene and all of a sudden is subject to a lot of scrutiny and to a crush of media, I call them up and say, you know, I've been to this rodeo and I've learned a few things. And here's my cell phone number. And if you ever want to talk, call me day or night. And I will try to be of help to you. So I called up Mayor Pete and said that to him, and it led to a longer conversation. And I would say it's fair to say that I have maintained a personal and pastoral relationship with him ever since, but I've had no real connection to the campaign itself.
Hmm. Well, it wouldn't be you if you hadn't done something like that.
I will say that getting to know him a bit has been a wonderful experience, and I think he's a wonderful human being.
Mm. Was his sexuality the first thing you learned about him, or did that come later?
Well, in those earliest days, it was the thing that all of the news reports and pieces being written about him began with, because that's what made him somewhat unique. I think the really striking thing is how small a role it played from then on. That is to say, everyone was talking about how smart he was, how well-spoken he was, how organized he was, how up on the issues he was. He spoke eight languages, but that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. All seemed to overshadow his sexuality.
Yeah. For millions of Americans, I know it was news to see an openly gay, happily married, deeply religious person on the national stage. Talk about why that is so important.
I don't think we've seen a person in public life, never mind politics, that so effectively and beautifully talked about the appropriate and rightful role of religion in the public square. That's what really caught my attention. Pretty much all of the candidates have some connection to religion, but this was different. Every time he talked about his own faith, he never missed saying, "This is about me, and your choices about your faith are your choices to make. And besides which, even if you don't identify with any faith tradition, you know, I mean to be your president." Mm-hmm. So every time he brought it up, he showed respect for other faith traditions, other world religions, as well as those who would identify with none of them.
Yeah.
That is the most remarkable thing about the way he has talked about this. And then the other way in which he's talked about it is in relation to his sexuality and his sexual orientation. And evidence of his effectiveness of doing that is that the religious right virtually has left him alone. And the reason, I think, is that he owns that space. He talks about his faith, and he talks about the Bible's role in his faith in such a way they dare not tangle with him, because he will run circles around them. And so it makes me very proud of him, and I think for LGBTQ people of faith, it is a remarkable addition to the public discourse.
You know, Gene, so many people think the struggle for the inclusion and dignity of LGBTQI persons is pretty much over in this country. In truth, almost every person comes to terms with a non-traditional sexual orientation or gender expression through a complicated and even dangerous process. And we know that role models can be an actual lifesaver during that process. With that in mind, what's the lasting effect of Mayor Pete's run for the White House?
Well, I said to him early on, and I've said it many times since, I said to him, regardless of how this political campaign turns out, whatever its result, the fact is that there is a gay teenager in Idaho or Alabama who now thinks he or she can be president of the United States. And what a remarkable thing. And nobody, absolutely nobody, can take that away from you. You've done that already. And it is an astounding thing to have done. You know, we fancy ourselves that this has all been worked out and there's no more problem with it in terms of a sexual orientation. That tends to be true of the East and West Coasts and a few big cities in between. But much of the country is not all that different than when I was growing up way too many years ago. With the exception of at least they know they're not alone because they've got the internet and they can find out that they're not the only one. But other than that, they face many of the same hardships and prejudices and discriminations that that existed back then. And you have to remember that in a majority of the states, there are no protections for LGBTQI people. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, it's still tough out there.
Yeah.
And we still have kids, you know, jumping off bridges and hating themselves because of the messages they get. So it's easy for many of us to believe that this fight is, you know, virtually over when in fact it's not.
I have to say, I was just stunned over and over again at how comfortable he was. When he was in front of people, he simply felt like, look, this is who I am. I am comfortable with this, and I'm going to be who I am as I speak. Where did that come from with him?
Yeah. Well, I don't know how he got comfortable, but here's what I do know. It has been my experience that people are as comfortable with you as you are with yourself. And so, I mean, I think that's part of what happened to me. I had nothing to apologize about in terms of my sexual orientation. And it just seemed like the most normal thing in the world to me. Mm-hmm. And because I acted that way, an awful lot of people began to treat it as if it was the most normal thing in the world. Mm-hmm. And that's the piece around Pete's candidacy that has been so dramatic. And I think has added so much to his success. Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right. He clearly adores his husband, and he's been able to use it And the few times that he's been asked about it, especially if it's been in a critical way, he was like, I love my husband. I'm faithful to my husband. And my history with him does not include paying off a porn star.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he's really savvy about how to maneuver in this way with his faith and with his sexuality. Where he learned that, I don't know, other than I will proudly say he came to the Episcopal Church as an adult. He is incredibly serious about it. A couple of months ago, he called up and said, I want to go to the National Cathedral for church this morning. Will you go with me? And I said, of course I will. So I arrive, and he and his entourage arrive. There is not a single press person there. There is not anyone at the cathedral who knows he's coming except for the dean, and I called the dean just so he had a heads up. He wasn't going there for a photo op. Mm-hmm. He was going there to worship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so he is dead serious about his faith.
Yeah.
And I think part of that faith, at least as we in the Episcopal Church interpret it, is the message that God created him the way he is, and God stood back and said, it is very good.
Gene, I couldn't help but notice the number of social media users identifying as gay who were generous in their criticism and even ridicule of Pete. Where do you suppose that kind of dark energy came from?
Well, you know, we are so used to talking about LGBTQI people as if they were some monolithic group that all believes the same things. And, the fact of the matter is we're as diverse as any other community.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's partly that. I also think that, we are living in a time of high polarization, and it doesn't take much to set someone off, and especially younger people who have been pushing for greater and faster change in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And it's why Bernie Sanders' campaign has attracted so many of them. So it didn't surprise me. And no one candidate is going to be everything to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Would you talk a little bit about the critical need for empathy at this moment in our history and the healing that it can offer for both those practicing and those on the receiving end of empathy?
I don't know that we have ever had leadership in Washington as non-empathetic as we have now. And that makes for a world that is, I don't know, was it John Locke who called life nasty, brutish, and short? It makes for a dangerous and painful world, and empathy seems to be at the very center of all that we hope for, right? If we are empathetic to people fleeing violence in Central America and arriving at our borders, if we are empathetic to what it's like to be one of those children, we wouldn't be putting them in cages. We would be welcoming them the way the Bible tells us to. If we were actually empathetic with the poor, we wouldn't be giving tax cuts to all the wealthy and letting the poor be every man, woman, and child for themselves.
Mm.
So it seems to me that much of what ails us and much of what troubles so many of us right now comes from that lack of empathy. I mean, going back to Mayor Pete, he never attacked his competitors the way that was, fairly common among the others. And it's just one of the things that I respect about him. And it just tells me that as a president, he would have been very high on that empathy scale.
One more question, Gene, and this one is not for the candidate. It is for the bishop.
okay.
As we move through this election cycle, What are the priorities that you are focusing on from a moral and ethical perspective?
Well, I try not to be too political publicly, but I would have to say that I think the greatest threat to the United States of America, as we both know it and as we want it to be, is the current leadership. Mm. And like so many people during this campaign, that is our highest priority, because frankly, none of the other specifics that I would want to work on in terms of policy and the way we treat other nations and the way we treat the most vulnerable in our own culture, none of that gets solved unless the leadership issue gets solved.
Yeah.
And so, again, like so many other people, it's my top issue. I'm not going to agree with anyone on every point of policy. But, I mean, we've had presidents, both Republican and Democrat, who are empathetic, who can be moved by someone's pain and don't have to relate it all just to themselves. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is the major goal of this campaign, and the rest will follow.
Mm. The Right Reverend Gene Robinson is the former Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire, the first openly gay person elevated to that role in historic Christianity. In retirement from that role, Gene has stayed active in ministry and social justice advocacy, currently holding the position of Vice President of Religion and Senior Pastor at the Chautauqua Institution in upstate New York. Gene, I don't know that looking at political television that I have ever cried before, but my wife and I sat watching the candidate this last week and saw something that is special, and we both cried seeing mm-hmm. someone in that position who is comfortable with himself and showing people how to be normal as normal can be and still be special. And
right.
I know you've had some part in that. Gene, I am so grateful for your thoughts at this historical moment. It's always great to be with you, but this was special, and I thank you for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio.
You're so welcome, Walton. And, you know, I love talking with you, and I love the issues that you raise. They're so important, and perhaps at this time, more important than they've ever been in our lifetime.
We're just getting started with this week's show. NCLR Born Perfect Campaign Virginia Ambassador Adam Trimmer will be here to talk about the new ban in that state protecting young persons from the pseudoscience of so-called reparative therapy. And later, a comprehensive voter guide courtesy of the Muslim Public Affairs Council. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Walton Gaddy. This week, Virginia Governor Ralph Northam signed House Bill 386 into law, banning the dangerous practice of so-called reparative therapy on underage persons. With a look at this important development, I am delighted to be joined by National Center for Lesbian Rights Born Perfect Campaign Virginia Ambassador Adam Trimmer. Adam, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
I know this issue is not just core to your work, but also personally significant to you individually. So what was it like seeing the governor sign this bill?
I'll tell you, it felt like the survivor community, the community of survivors of conversion therapy, were heard. Our stories have really been treated like the ones who didn't do it right by these ex-gay groups, by the people providing conversion therapy. And to know that the regulatory boards, the legislators, and now the governor of Virginia is on our side, this feels like a huge win for our community in Virginia.
Virginia was the first southern state to take this step. Why is that particularly significant?
That's significant because when you think about the South, you think about regions like the Bible Belt. And, you know, you think about how difficult it is for someone who identifies as part of the LGBTQ community to grow up in a southern region where it is evangelical, conservative, Christian churches as just the way of life of the majority of the population. So for Virginia to be showing the South that we can stand up for our community and win is a huge message to people who are in that situation right now, where they may not feel heard, where they may feel invalidated by the world around them. But in the South, we have a voice and we can use it and people will listen.
A lot of Americans wouldn't believe that this practice is still happening at all, never mind on vulnerable young people. Would you be willing to talk about how widespread and how dangerous Pray Away the Gay quackery really is?
It's a valid question, and I think it's so important to talk about the core of it, which is manipulation of vocabulary, because the very existence of the concept of conversion therapy is challenged by people who are providing conversion therapy. And what I mean by that is they will say that they are helping somebody heal from unwanted same-sex attraction, but they will never acknowledge that individual as gay, right? So that's one way of vocabulary manipulation. Why that's significant is because they will take that same set of principles to say, if we use this vocabulary, then this is inerrant and this is correct and this is the only way that it is. And when we say something, it manipulates the truth, but that's the way that it is. And so when they say we don't provide conversion therapy, it's because they're taking that vocabulary manipulation. What they're actually saying is, I am helping someone, quote unquote, heal from unwanted same-sex attraction or, quote unquote, a transgender identity that needs to be fixed. But it's not conversion therapy to them because that's not what they're calling it. But the reality is, any attempt to change someone's sexual orientation or gender identity is part of this conversion therapy. And this bill specifically applies to licensed professionals in the state of Virginia that are regulated by the Department of Health Professions.
What else do Americans of goodwill need to know about the harm of ex-gay practices?
That's a great question. So the principle of it is that being gay doesn't exist, of course, is something that they will tell people who go to their programs. But also that same-sex attraction, as they call it, comes from something, right? So they will dig and dig and try to find what that quote-unquote something is and then try to fix that something. So now you not only are denying who you are, but you're also having your entire life brought into question, skewing everything you know, the core of your identity, and so many different things that are brought into question for the sole purpose of trying to create a recovery program. So I experienced multiple forms of conversion therapy at the age of 18, and it's something that children should never be subjected to. It's manipulative, it is not helpful, and there is nothing wrong with being part of our community.
How do you get over that?
I had to go through some really intense yet amazing counseling with a fantastic therapist. And I say this all the time. Nobody should ever have to go through therapy because of therapy. I had to kind of unrewire everything that was manipulated during my experiences in conversion therapy. So I wound up as a quote-unquote ex-gay after a suicide attempt during my coming out process. A pastor had told me that I tried being gay and look what happened, and that I needed to change my vocabulary. So that's where it started. And then I started seeing a counselor. I started going to a local ministry in Richmond. I started going to a bunch of ex-gay conferences. And it was just like I was bought into this. I believed this was going to work. I believed that at some point I was going to walk away as a heterosexual. And to add an even further depth of how deep I got into this, I was also seeing these people who were quote-unquote success stories because they were standing there next to people they'd married and said, look, this can be you. And I believed that lie, and a lot of us believe that lie. And if anybody's listening and has at any point in their life thought that being gay could be cured and has bought into that lie, just know that, one, you are not alone, and two, you are not crazy. This is not your fault. This is something that a system has tried to suppress our identities. And unfortunately, there are so many casualties. But if you have experienced this, you are a survivor. And you deserve to celebrate your pride because you deserve to feel pride and not the shame that we experience in these programs.
The National Center for Lesbian Rights has long made exposing and opposing ex-gay pseudoscience a priority. Would you talk about that and the Born Perfect campaign, please?
Of course. So Born Perfect is a campaign to end conversion therapy. Virginia is the 20th state to end conversion therapy. And I feel that's significant because the year is 2020. We are state number 20, and 2020 vision, perfect vision. This is a perfect vision for the state of Virginia to become a queer affirming part of the South. So Born Perfect, it supports ending conversion therapy through legislation, like the legislation that just passed through Virginia, through education, educating the community. For example, we did a couple movie screenings around the state of Virginia. And, you know, we just have several different opportunities to educate about not only my experience, but the experiences of other survivors of conversion therapy and of the damage that it causes. We're doing an event here soon that's kind of focused on healing from conversion therapy. And of course, through litigation, right? So as things get challenged, it's important to be able to uphold these bills. And the Born Perfect campaign historically has. And, you know, I have no doubt that if there is any challenge in Virginia, that Born Perfect and the National Center for Lesbian Rights would be able to uphold these pieces of legislation.
While Virginia now becomes the 20th state in the union to outlaw the practice on minors, as you've just pointed out, it's clear much more needs to be done. Certainly, LGBTQI persons over the age of 18 can be victimized. Are there strategies for expanding protections beyond minors?
So that's a great question, and I think the most powerful thing that we can do in that space is educate. So I think of my friend Garrett Conley, his memoir, Boy Erased, that was released and turned into the film. He was 18 when this happened as well. And, you know, the education that came about because of that film was incredible. People were starting to see portrayed what happens in conversion therapy. And, you know, the more that we're able to educate our community, the more chance that we have of potentially saving lives from having these parents believe that their children can be changed or that something is wrong with them. So I think how we combat that at this point is education, to make sure that everyone understands exactly what's happening in these programs, because the reality is that if somebody is 18 and goes to these programs, then, you know, it's not like a parent sending their child against their will. It is something that that adult does have to consent to, but it doesn't mean that they're not going to be misled.
As I understand it, the protections only apply to licensed mental health providers. That would mean that vast swaths of unlicensed organizations and leaders cloaked in claimed religious beliefs continue to have unfettered access to the bodies and souls of vulnerable LGBTQI young people. Are there options for changing that in the future?
I think the big question that I would ask is somebody spending money? I think about the story of Alex Cooper. If you've seen her story portrayed in a Lifetime film that came out several months ago, she actually sued and won in a situation that was provided by a religious group. So, yeah, I think there is a really strong level of protection that our community has against this. However, coming forward to talk about your experiences is one of the most vulnerable places that we can put ourselves in. And so I think it's important for everyone to know that if you've experienced this, you are not alone, and it is okay to talk about it, and it is okay to see what your options are as it relates to taking action regarding your experiences. When it comes to licensed mental health offices, these are regulated professions. And it's going to be so important that our community finds a safe haven when they go to a counselor or a therapist or a doctor. And the Virginia Health Board, paired with the General Assembly and now the governor, have ensured that our youth will have that safe haven if they're part of our community, that they will not be taken down this path to say that you are broken because you are either transgender or gay or lesbian or any other part of our community, that they will be able to seek care for what actual issues are happening in their life, and they'll be protected from that. And if they experience something like that, that they can file a complaint. And that is a big win for the state of Virginia.
Proponents of pray away the gay quackery are actively challenging even the level of protections in the name of free speech and under the guise of religious liberty. Are there strategies for countering that kind of well-funded, carefully coordinated campaign?
That's a great question. And here in Virginia, that is essentially already taken care of, because the licensing boards have actually produced something called a guidance document on several different health boards that have defined what conversion therapy is and that it's harmful. And there were opponents that said it was a free speech issue. The boards have been very clear. The General Assembly has been very clear. And now with the passage of the bill and the signing of the bill by the governor has been very clear. This is not free speech just because words are coming out of a therapist or a counselor's mouth. This is a regulated health profession. And so this is something where the appropriate boards are able to hold their licensed professionals accountable if they engage in this type of quote-unquote science that is not valid and hasn't been valid since homosexuality was removed from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual in 1973.
How do we get people to understand that the struggle is far from over and that every step forward inspires a backlash that requires tireless vigilance and organizing?
What we need is we need for people to see the survivor community. When we share our experiences, we need for people to listen and to understand that even if you're just seeing one person sharing their story, you are seeing a glimpse into an entire world that exists that we have found ourselves trapped in at one point in our lives. We need the conversation to spread. We need people to share about what is conversion therapy, what is the damage that it causes, and why is it a bad thing. We need for these conversations to happen everywhere. Even with the protections that are enacted, we need for our community to know that these protections do exist. Because ultimately, these boards are going to be able to hold the licensed professionals accountable if complaints are filed. And so we need for everyone to understand what these protections mean, how to file a complaint, and what conversion therapy is. It is something that has wrecked so many lives and so many families, including my own. And the time for silence is over. We need for people to understand that there are massive organizations that are making profits off of promising that they can help someone heal from homosexuality or from same-sex attraction or to help somebody deal with, quote-unquote, unwanted same-sex attraction.
Adam, what would you say to any LGBTQI young person who is struggling with their sexual identity or gender expression right now, whether due to family pressure, religious dogmas, or societal bigotry, what do they need to hear right at this moment from a survivor of ex-gay pseudoscience?
Thank you so much for that question. If you are experiencing shame regarding who you are, know that you are perfect just the way you are. There are resources available if you need to speak with somebody. There are incredible resources in the state of Virginia, such as the LGBT Life Center, such as Launchpad Counseling, which is multiple different organizations that specifically are able to help parts of our community. It is okay to seek that help, and that help is not conversion therapy. There is nothing wrong with who you are. You don't want to fall down this trap of trying to change yourself or of trying to suppress yourself because you deserve better. You deserve to feel pride. You deserve to have an absence of the shame that you're feeling right now. And it is absolutely possible to get there. And we are here as a community to support you on that path.
Adam Trimmer is Virginia Ambassador for the Born Perfect campaign from the National Center for Lesbian Rights. With the governor's signature on House Bill 386, this week, the Commonwealth of Virginia becomes the 20th state in the Union to outlaw so-called ex-gay therapy on underage victims. Adam, it breaks my heart to know how many innocent LGBTQI lives have been subjected to the torture of ex-gay quackery, and especially that it's almost always done in the name of religion. I am grateful you have come through that horrific experience with the open heart and generosity of spirit needed for the kind of activism you engage in today. And I celebrate with you this important step forward. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. This is a time of celebration for Virginia, and I'm so grateful to have you there celebrating with us. Thank you so much.
Donald Trump arguably built his entire presidential campaign on the politics of exclusion. From build that wall on the border with Mexico to fear-mongering against American Muslims, there are large numbers of voters with more motivation than ever to head to the polls this November. Helpfully, advocacy groups are stepping up to offer some guidance on policies and priorities to consider before stepping into the voting booth. And the Muslim Public Affairs Council has just issued its comprehensive Muslim Voters Guide. With a sneak peek, I'm joined by Impact Communications and Marketing Manager Rahima Shahab. Welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Hi, thank you so much. Thank you for having me on.
This is not the first time that the council has issued a voter guide, right?
We generally actually publish one for every major campaign that goes on. For Obama, we did it during the Bush era. So we've generally done a voter's guide.
What were the goals that you had in mind while putting together the guide this year?
Our main goal is to make sure that our community, that American Muslims, are educated as they head to the polls so that they're able to make a holistic decision as they choose, their nominee for the primaries. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to basically include issues that matter to those voters the most.
For 2020, Impact surveyed a large number of Muslim Americans to identify key issues of concern. Would you talk about some of those findings?
Yeah, definitely. So we issued a survey before we started working on the report that included a whole list of various issues that always come up during the debates or just in general with American Muslims. And we asked our supporters, people on Muslims online, basically anybody, to rank what matters to them the most. Mm-hmm. And we were going to address the top 10 issues. And in that, we found that, the Muslim voter is way more concerned with just foreign policy. I think there's this myth or stereotype out there that because Muslims, are an immigrant population, which also is an inaccurate myth, that we really only worry about foreign policy and what's going on, quote unquote, back home. Mm-hmm. So we found that that's definitely not true. One of the biggest, the top issue that came back was healthcare. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, in the very, top of the findings was healthcare, gun reform, civil rights and liberties, and then foreign policy was definitely still in there. It's a big concern, I think, for many Americans, not just Muslims, but there were things that preceded that. So I think, the report showed that American Muslims care for a pretty big variety of issues, not just a foreign policy. And it kind of shows, I guess, the depth and diversity of our community.
Mm-hmm. Is there a profile of the Muslim American voter that starts to emerge as you look through the answers to all of those people?
I would say that there isn't. We had other questions in there as well, not just this, kind of a catch-all question that asked, did we miss anything? And just reading through the answers of that specifically, you can tell that, the community is so diverse and they care about so many different things that we really weren't able to sort of create a profile. There's American Muslims that have, only been here in America, right? Like the the Black community of American Muslims. And then you have the Latino voters who are American Muslims. You have the South Asians. You have the converts. So that profile definitely, I think, just didn't emerge. The kind of thing that we're finding over and over again, something that we've known, but I think that this proves, is that, you know, the American Muslims are not a monolith. Mm-hmm. There's just so much depth and nuance within our community.
Were there any surprises in the data that you gathered?
Not really. I think just the surprising was what's surprising was just how high up issues like healthcare and gun reform were over like civil liberties. Mm-hmm. I think it kind of indicated to me personally that American Muslims have this very like Muslim issues, I guess civil liberties. We do sometimes, because of the Muslim ban and sort of discriminatory policy, see it as a big Muslim issue. Whereas like healthcare is like an any person issue, right? Each of us needs healthcare. Each of us can be denied access to it. So I think that was a little surprising, but I think it was a good surprise.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Sure. How many candidates were you able to hear from directly?
So before we released this report, we actually did a preliminary report that sort of did the research on how candidates were engaging with American Muslims. Mm-hmm. And we found that there were definitely a few candidates that stood out. We were able to talk to the Sanders campaign a lot, the Warren campaign as well. We had contact, I believe, with the Biden, Bloomberg, Buttigieg campaigns. But then the others, I definitely think that, you know, there was a lack of discussion with. I think the Yang campaign as well. Mm-hmm. We had some back and forth with. But yeah, there was, I think that part of the report really illustrated, and I think we marked which ones that we didn't hear from as well after, you know, many attempts of outreach. But this time, more than any, campaigns were willing and doing the outreach on themselves. It wasn't even us reaching out. They reached out to, whether it was our organization or others, like campaigns did a lot of outreach efforts to some communities specifically to get out their vote.
What does that tell us about the strength of the Muslim American community as a voting bloc?
It tells us a lot. It tells us that this bloc is definitely important to do outreach to. And I think this year, the 2020 year, more than ever, just shows the strength in numbers. You know, Muslims make up about, I would say, like 1% of the population, but that's a huge number, especially when it comes to this kind of election with so many people running. There's a lot that can be said for getting, you know, sort of the buy-in of this community. So there's a huge, there's a lot of voting power within our community. And I think campaigns are realizing that. I think one of the first times that this strength shows was during, I believe, the Bush-Kerry campaign, when about 20% of Muslims, or about 20% of the vote for Bush came from the Muslim population. Mm-hmm. Some like really, you know, high statistic like that. Mm-hmm. So that was the first time that this was indicated. But now we're seeing it more than ever, especially as Muslim engagement increases. As more Muslims head to the poll, more and more campaigns engage with the Muslims. So it's kind of like a cyclical effect as well. Mm-hmm. But there's that power exists there, and we're seeing it more and more.
So now, are there other ongoing voter education or registration programs that MPAC is participating in between now and November?
Yeah, so our programs are definitely going to grow as we go on. We're going to make more and more releases of the voter guide. You know, as people drop in, more issues come up, we're going to continue to educate voters. And then we have several programs lined up, you know, that have a lot more to do with like voter education as well as platform education. So there's a lot more coming up before November 2020.
How can our listeners get their hands on the Muslim Public Affairs Council voter guide, and how can they keep up to date with what's going on in your shop?
So all they have to do is go to mpac.org, and the Muslim voter guide is the first thing there. And they just click on it, and then they can download it. And the same link is where we'll keep updating all that information, as well as more information on voting in 2020 and what people need to know before they head to the polls.
Is there anything else our listeners need to know about this project that I haven't asked you?
I don't think so. I think just the most important thing is go out and vote. It doesn't matter whether you're Muslim. It doesn't matter whether, you know, you're Christian or Jewish or Black or brown. Just go out and vote. Use your power. Vote your conscience. It's the most important thing as we, you know, head into this very, very critical year for any community, any ally.
Rahima Shoaib is Communications and Marketing Manager at the Muslim Public Affairs Council, a national public affairs nonprofit organization working to promote and strengthen American pluralism by increasing understanding and improving policies that impact American Muslims. Rahima, thank you for what you've done on this, and thank you for taking the time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for the show.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say a very sincere thank you. Your generous support of this program is vital to keeping us on the air. Now, if you think there's value in what you've heard here, and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And do you know someone who you think might benefit from hearing what you're hearing? Please commit to sharing State of Belief with just one person this week. Do it on social media. Do it in person. See that someone learns about the show. It is incredibly helpful to know that we are reaching more and more people, especially at a time such as this. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.